from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 1 month ago today, January 18th, when Rochester City Councilman Malik Evans announced that he is running for mayor. Evans has worked in public service for nearly two decades. He was only 23 years old when he was first elected to the Rochester City School Board. Now he's challenging incumbent Mayor Lovely Warren, who is running for a third term. Both are Democrats. Evans has so far avoided saying much about the mayor, but her campaign has not hesitated to take a shot at him. After Evans announced his mayoral bid, the mayor's team released a statement accusing him of being just another black man trying to hold black women down. Evans says he wants to focus on the issues. So what are those issues? For starters, he told the Rochester Beacon that he wants the expansion of universal pre-K to be on his tombstone. He talks a lot about education, and of course, he's worked as a board member. He'll have to address policing and how he views the department's handling of recent high-profile cases. So there's a lot to talk about. This hour, it's our chance to speak to the candidate directly. My guest is Malik Evans, member of Rochester City Council and a candidate for mayor of the city of Rochester. Malik, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Evan, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I spoke to one of your old classmates in high school who told me that during the graduation speech, we're talking late 1990s, he gave a graduation speech, and he said at that speech that Malik Evans would be the first black president of this country. Do you remember that?
Vaguely, but he might have been talking about first president of my neighborhood association.
No, he was not. Yeah. Okay, well, listen, I think you know Chad, and he told me that you had always been dedicated to true community service from an early age, not the kind of service intended to get headlines or recognition for yourself. And that's why you made some of those comments at graduation. And then he sent me a note saying the following. He said, quote, "I was always amazed with the connection he has to the people of our community. I remember walking around the Cornhill Arts Festival with him when we were in our late 20s and being in awe of how we couldn't get two steps without him being stopped by somebody and him engaging in a real conversation with people. It was amazing. It was as if he knew each and every one of them by name and actually cared about what they had to say. It was awe-inspiring," end quote. When did you start to really think in a sort of service-minded way? Because your classmates say it was really, really early, and that's kind of what they noticed about you right away. When do you remember starting to think that way?
Since when I was a child, you know, my father and mother were very much committed to service, and they instilled that in us at a very early age. You know, we were raised with the mantra, "To whom much is given, much is expected." So I always remind people that I came to public service by community service, and I was just saying this to a group of young people on Tuesday when I was talking to the Genesee Land Trust. They have a youth group, and I came up through Teen Court when Teen Court first started coming to Rochester. I was involved in the original Teen Court model when, after Bill Johnson went to Galveston, Texas, we brought Teen Court as a way to reduce recidivism, but also get folks, young folks in particular, interested in the law. So we did that. I started the City County Youth Council, which worked to bridge the gaps between young people in the suburbs in the city to find community service projects that we could work together to kind of break down walls. And that organization went on to become Youth Voice, One Vision. I was involved with the Youth Participation Project, the Youth as Resources Program, which is still around, a grant program that started with young people. So this started at a very, very young age, and I can go on and on about how I was involved as a child that was not old enough to drive. And it continued on my time when I went over to the University of Rochester, founded the College Diversity Roundtable, which is still up and running, after some protests that took place there that I was involved in as a student. And the Martin Luther King Commemorative Address. I was the Students Association Treasurer at the U of R, ran a tutoring program at school number 8. So it goes on and on. So my service to the community, as I've always said, started not with elected office, but with trying to serve others, and it just morphed into me becoming an elected official.
I take the point that, you know, your parents impressed upon you the importance of thinking about not just yourself, but your community. But was there... is there like a first memory of something that moved you, either outraged you or concerned you or caused you to want to seek some sort of change?
Yeah, I think I think one of the things that outraged me a lot when I was when I was younger was I grew up in the South Wedge neighborhood, and when I was growing up in the South Wedge neighborhood, it was not like it is today. And I witnessed, and my father intervened in a lot of societal issues that we had. So, you know, drug dealers. I had someone shot outside my house. Two folks that had just got released from prison. They were running down the street, and you know, and my father was called to testify on that case. So I got to see firsthand what happens to a community when there are not good social safety nets, and when there is not good jobs, good access to education and economic opportunities. But we wouldn't complain about that. We would say, what can we do to try to fix it? And I think that's, for me, what this campaign has also been about, because we see what's happening in our city. We see what's happening across the country. And it's so easy to be the critic from the peanut gallery, but it's harder to get in the arena. And I said, wait a minute, I need to get in the arena. So those types of incidences really, I think, pressed me. The other thing, too, that spurs me is that, unfortunately, I had a lot of friends die extremely young. So one of my first memories is I had a friend pass away at 6 years old on our way to Darien Lake with her father. They got hit by a fire truck. And my father said something to me then. He goes, life is extremely short. And when you leave this earth, not to sound morbid, he said, people are going to remember what you did. So you need to make sure that you commit yourself to something higher than yourself. Now, I had no idea what he was talking about. But as I've grown as a man and as I've watched him, it's service. It's service to others, and it's service to the community. You know, I always tell people that I could have moved and done all types of other things, but I feel an unbiding commitment to this community and to whom much is given, which Rochester has given a lot to me. I always felt as though that I needed to serve, and that's why I took on some of the hardest assignments there are, school board, and city council is not easy, and now being a candidate for mayor.
Who is your political hero?
Wow. Well, there's a couple. You know, I have a distant cousin, Levi Dawson, who was one of the first African Americans, you know, elected from Chicago. You know, he pushed for civil rights in his way when he was in Congress. So he's been someone that I've studied because he kind of was a trailblazer for other African Americans that came through Congress. I also thought very highly of Adam Clayton Powell, who was out of New York City, because not only was he a community activist with a large church. I mean, I come from my father was a preacher, but he fused that activism but action at the same time. And I'm one of those people that do that. Like I've never been one. I have to get better at it now. My campaign team says you have to get better at telling what you've done, what you've worked on. I've never been one to do that. And Adam Clayton Powell was kind of that way too. I mean, yeah, he was an elected official, but he worked hard within that community in Harlem to transform it for jobs, and to push economic development within those blocks. And I believe that if you look at the way Harlem is now, many could argue that folks like Adam Clayton Powell back in the 50s and 60s, kind of helped lead that renaissance because he understood the importance of using political power for people other than yourself. And so he's someone that I admire. And I also admire Barbara Jordan, who was a congresswoman out of Texas, as well as Shirley Chisholm, who was also a barrier breaker.
Let me just read a little bit about William Levi Dawson, who was the third African-American elected to Congress in the 20th century, the first black member to chair a standing committee, was known for forceful but generally behind-the-scenes action through his political career, and in public kept a reserved demeanor and a reluctance to alienate too many people in politics, wanted to be a bridge builder. That sounds a lot like Malik Evans. Are you you said you have a distant relation to Levi Dawson?
Yeah, he's a distant cousin. So my mother's maiden name, my mother comes from the Dawsons, right.
Okay, and now people may be wondering what kind of Democrat you view yourself as today, because the party has seen, as really all political parties do, some sort of push and pull in different directions. You know, certainly a year ago in a presidential primary, you had a lot of different viewpoints about what direction the country needed to go and how swiftly and forcefully it needed to go to get there. I mean, as an example, who did you support in the presidential primary before it got settled out?
In the presidential primary, I was pushing for Kamala Harris. You know, Kamala is a member of the D9, which is a strong, you know, African-American and African-American male and female sororities and fraternities. So I supported Kamala Harris in the primary.
Okay. And, you know, if there is, if there's a common kind of criticism or concern I'm hearing from listeners is that they don't have much of an idea for what you specifically want to do now. Let me read a few comments I received before your appearance on this program about that. A listener named Jordan says, I hope Evan pushes him and forces some specifics out of him because a bunch of vague, meaningless platitudes about building bridges and transparency ain't going to cut it. He's running seemingly alone against an unpopular, corrupt incumbent. He has the chance to be bold. Kristen sent us a note saying, we need more than a Buttigieg or Biden type in Rochester. We need an Elizabeth Warren type with a plan for everything and the will to go big. And this is from city resident and a county legislator, Rachel Barnhart. She writes, Malik Evans is going to need to present plans and be substantive and mayoral. The go high but say nothing route is risky. I fear he's not much different than Mayor Warren policy-wise, and his play is, at least I'm not corrupt. Do you think that point is fair, that you've been taking the high road, but the high road is sort of go high but say nothing?
No, and I think you always have to consider the source. I sincerely and vigorously disagree with the county legislator and her comment. Yes, I don't get that, but... I'm a plan guy. I'm an idea guy. And as the campaign continues to roll out, we will continue to obviously vigorously discuss the issues because it is extremely important in this race that someone not vote against someone, but I want them to vote for something. And we will make it clear on what we want to vote for. Public safety reform, right? Real substantive public safety reform that allows our citizens to be safer and for us to have a better economic future. So public safety will be a top priority in our administration because we know that Rochester will not be able to thrive if we do not reform public safety from top to bottom, and not in a piecemeal approach, but in a comprehensive approach. So what does that mean? That means ensuring that police officers are not dealing with mental health calls, and that if we're going to have a mental health unit, that it is effective, staffed up, and able to meet the needs of our citizens, so we don't see the type of incidences like we saw recently with the 9-year-old girl. That also means that we are going to have to make sure that we address recidivism and job opportunities, because you can't have a better public safety without people having access to jobs. So we will look at that from a holistic standpoint. So public safety is important. Neighborhood voice, how neighborhoods feel they are connecting to the overall community is extremely important. Ensuring that we increase home ownership in the city of Rochester. So home ownership in the city of Rochester, according to the second quarter of the Federal Reserve, is about like 35-36%. We know that home ownership builds generational wealth. So how are we doing in each of our quadrants in our neighborhoods, and what can the city do to help spur more home ownership, right? Getting more people to stay, because we know that helps neighborhoods. And let's make Rochester be known for something from a job perspective. How are we doing in that area? How can we get Rochester at full employment? And full employment, you know, the definition is, you know, more less than 3%. Anybody looking for a job can find a job. How can we build public-private partnerships when in a city like Rochester with 220,000 residents, we can create jobs for anyone that wants to get one? And that means a focus on small business. You know, if one in three small businesses create at least one job, America could be at full employment. That's a very important statistic because it shows you the power of small businesses. They become large businesses. We can do that. Rochester can be known as a data science hub. We have schools like RIT and organizations that are focusing on those things. So there are lots of ideas and plans that I have for the city because, you know, our people shall perish for a lack of vision. And we definitely have that vision. But I think that sometimes what happens in these races is people focus more on personality. So they're on Facebook, they're on Twitter, so they think because they are saying something, in actuality they're really saying nothing because they're not offering really what they want to see for the city. And that's what I want to do. I want to be able to offer that. And we will always work to improve our messaging to make sure that we get that message out. And that's the challenge of any campaign. And we're going to work overtime to make sure that gets out, so that way when the county legislator that made her comment, hopefully will meet her specifications as the weeks unfold.
Talking to Malik Evans, who is a member of Rochester City Council and is a candidate for mayor of Rochester. And I realize you want to take the high road. I know I'm not the first to ask you about this, but when the mayor accuses you of being just another black man trying to hold black women down, you don't think that warrants a response?
You know what warrants a response? Me talking about the people that I want to lift up. The fact that people in Rochester, particularly in black and brown communities, are disproportionately affected by COVID, maybe working two jobs. And then when they wake up in the mornings that after COVID started raging, they're missing one job. They're looking to get help from the federal government and not getting it because we need a bigger stimulus package. The folks that are interested in making sure their kids are able to catch up because they missed school over during the COVID, or the neighborhoods in which we have unemployment rates approaching 7%. Those are the people that I'm interested in looking up, lifting up, and looking up. And that's what I stay focused on this race, because responding to any comments that folks put out will knock you off the goal, and you have to keep your eye on the prize. And the eye on the prize is a better Rochester, and that is absolutely critical. What does that have to do with a 9-year-old girl getting sprayed with pepper spray, or the death of Daniel Prude, which has torn this city apart, and folks having a person die in March and then hearing about it in September. So, I mean, those are the issues that we need to focus on, and that is what I'm going to do as we roll out this campaign.
It's fair enough, and I want to make it clear that as I seek to make sure our listeners understand who you are and what you intend to do better, some of that is understanding contrast among candidates. It is not meant for clickbait or for headlines or for anything salacious. We're trying to understand differences. And so just closing the loop on what the mayor has said there, do you think the general point that the mayor is trying to make is true, that black men have historically pushed black women aside instead of elevating their voices?
History doesn't dictate that, and I'm a student of history. History has shown that there has always been a partnership between black men and black women, and I will continue that partnership as we go forward.
Now, let's talk about justice issues. You've raised them a number of times. There's a website called theappeal.org. They focus on justice issues, and writing for theappeal.org, here's Meg O'Connor looking at the scandals in Rochester over the past year. She writes, quote, "In Lovely Warren's past year as mayor of Rochester, members of the city's police department have handcuffed a 10-year-old child during a traffic stop, pepper sprayed a distressed 9-year-old girl, and pushed a man's head into the pavement until he stopped breathing, then tried to cover it up. Now, Warren is running for a third term, despite calls for her resignation and an indictment for two felony campaign finance charges hanging over her head. Her only challenger so far for the June primary is a Rochester City Council member, Malik Evans, who is campaigning on a promise to build bridges and is not promising to be that different from Warren when it comes to reining in the police department," end quote. Is that a fair way of looking at what you are promising?
Absolutely not. And, you know, I've never even talked to this reporter. I think I got an email from this reporter. I've never heard of the appeal. But if I would have had a conversation with the reporter, I would have been happy to answer her questions. But I think that absolutely not. I am for absolute transformation of the police department, because we have to have transformation for the police department from a financial perspective, right? It costs city taxpayers money if we have to settle lawsuits, if we have to settle claims for uses of force. So even from a financial standpoint, it's important to have that reform. From a social justice standpoint, we have to have that type of reform. We can't have 9-year-old children, my son just turned 10 last year, getting sprayed with pepper spray. We can't have, for example, protesters peaceful protesters getting sprayed with pepper spray. You cannot defend the indefensible, which is something that I will never do. And I believe that some of this reform even goes beyond things that are put on paper. There are things that we need to do immediately within the Rochester Police Department, one of which is saying we don't spray children with pepper spray. That's easy. That's an easy thing to do, right? We don't use LRADs on peaceful protesters. So those types of things are what I call low-hanging fruit. New York City, which is much bigger than Rochester, they don't use LRADs on, for example, on protesters. So you have to have that type of reform very, 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 very early on. So, yeah, no, I disagree with the reporter. I had not heard of the appeal until I heard from several people who said, wait a minute, who's this newspaper article? And I remember not having the opportunity to talk to the reporter, but I would love to speak with her and delve deeper into her questions that she might have.
All right, let's hit some more specifics here. When it comes to actual numbers of police officers, we know the Police Accountability Board has studied how Rochester compares as a department of its size to others. One of the aspects that they emphasized is that we have more police officers per capita than many other cities of our size. In fact, double compared to some cities. Do we have too many police officers? Would you cut the number of police officers? And if so, by how much?
Yeah, I don't know by how much, but I will tell you that there is clear data that says more police officers do not make people more safe, right? How you make people more safe is by ensuring that you have a police department that has the trust within the community. Because when you have a homicide, for example, you want people in the community to be able to connect with those police officers to give them that information. So that means that you have to have a great relationship with the people who you are serving to protect, right? So that's important. The other thing that's important is that police officers can't see everything as a nail. If you're a hammer, you're going to see everything as a nail. So you have to ensure that you are hiring people who are caring, compassionate, and use common sense. So that's important. So, you know, what that number should come down to, I don't know off the top of my head, but I would say that this notion that, you know, if you have tons and tons of police officers, it makes people safer. What you have to do is be able to create the environment in which people have trust of the police department, that there's transparency in the police department, and that will lead to safety. It also will lead to less funds being spent on lawsuits for uses of force. So it makes economic sense, and it makes good common sense for us to make sure that we reform the police department in a way that works for the entire community.
Police substations in various neighborhoods have been debated. Do you support or oppose new substations?
I think, again, that we have to make sure that there is high levels of community involvement, you know, because those spaces could be used as community spaces, but you have to be able to make sure that you are involved with the members of the community and what they want to see there. I have been very, very good at that over the years. I think that's one of the reasons why I have been able to work with so many of our neighborhood groups, because they know that I talk to folks in the neighborhood. And you mentioned what Chad said earlier leading up to that. You know, oftentimes what happens is we have people who purport to speak for neighbors, and they never talk to the neighbors. So that's what a mayor has to do, to see what it is that people want. And, you know, there are some people who want neighborhood service centers and police stations in their neighborhood, but I think that requires a robust discussion of trade-offs and what people want to see. And a mayor has to lead those types of discussions, absolutely.
When you talk about sending mental health specialists instead of police, Mayor Warren has announced a plan to have more calls be responded to by mental health specialists. Do you support the plan that she rolled out? Would you change it specifically?
Well, you know, I support the city council plan. If you remember, city council started talking about this almost immediately after Daniel Prude. We absolutely have to make sure that we have to have more integration and coordination, because if you look at the incident, for example, with the 9-year-old girl, that came in as a car that was stolen, but yet no mental health professionals ended up coming on the scene when it became clear that was a clearly mental health issue, right? So we have to make sure that it's coordinated and is effective, and that means making sure that 911, the police are joined at the hip and communicating in a way where we can deploy mental health professionals whenever. Not just for a specific call, but it needs to be almost on demand. So if you come and it's supposed to be a car and you realize it's something else, it can't be that we have to say, oh, we couldn't deploy a mental health professional. So that process, I know the current process is a pilot. That current process will need to be beefed up, expanded. We will also need to work with the county to see how we interact with the county's team. The county has a fit team. So I think all those things will need to be ironed out. The other thing that needs to happen is, and this is when Cedric Alexander was chief, him and Sergeant Weaver at the time, there were dozens and dozens and dozens of police officers trained in handling mental health calls. And that went by the wayside in the mid 2000s. And if you're talking about revolutionizing and changing the way policing is done, it is very critical that we also change the training as it relates to police, because what we saw with the 9-year-old girl, I think, illustrates that other types of training are extremely important. But the first line of defense needs to be the mental health professionals, particularly when you're dealing with a child or you're dealing with an emotionally disturbed person. You can't use, and I said this on your show before, my father worked in mental health for years. He didn't carry a badge or a gun, but he was very effective in dealing with people who who were dealing with mental health issues. And so that has to be a major, major focus, I think, going forward of police reform. And the data shows, the data is very clear, that folks with mental challenges or mental health issues, they're more likely to be killed by police officers, not just in Rochester, but across the country. So by not having a mental health professional involved in these types of calls, it's deadly serious, and it has serious consequences that often lead to death, and we can't stand for that.
Now, the mayor, has unfortunately has not come on this program since the summer of 2017. She didn't like how the last conversation we had went, and she has chosen not to come back on this program. The door remains open, and I certainly hope that that we can come to an agreement, that we can have a fair conversation, and I would look forward to that if she would accept our invitation in the future. So I can't speak for her, but I do suspect, Malik, she would say, look, everything that you're saying, we are working on. That's exactly what we are doing. Do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure folks may be working on. I'm sure, but well, you know, we have to work. Working is good, but the proof is in the pudding. I think that we have to be able to do that in an effective way, and it has to be effective, and it has to be done in a way that is going to create transformational change. The other thing I'll say is, what we also have to do is everything that we do, trust and transparency has to be the undergirding factors, and you also have to build bridges. You know, it's funny, people. Some people have said, oh, yeah, we don't need to build bridges. But that theme, by the way, of bridge building that I'm talking about, that's not something I made up. That's something that, as I was talking to people about running, I said, why do I need to run? What do we need to do? And they said, build bridges. So in order for the stuff that we just talked about to work, you have to build a bridge to the county. You have to build a bridge to neighborhood organizations. You have to build a bridge to activists. You have to build a bridge to families and communities in the schools. And that's something that I will be able to do. But that bridge can't be built upon straw. It has to be built upon the foundation of trust and transparency.
Well,
and that's what this campaign is about. And that's what I think I will do in order to make those things that I just mentioned effective. Because it can't just be things that are on paper. They're things that have to be able to be operationalized and effective in order to impact the lives of the people that we are trying to help.
Now, I know that you were there, listening to the many hours of testimony given by Laron Singletary, the former police chief, recently to counsel. And, he talked about some of the communication that he had with Mayor Warren about what happened with Daniel Prude, for example. When you say that you can't really succeed in the changes you want to implement if you don't have trust, let me ask you, based on what you have heard and understood about the Prude case, did the mayor lose the community's trust with that?
Well, you know, there's a report that's going to come out on that, and I think the community will be able to make that judgment for themselves. I believe that she lost your trust? I will tell you that I've been an elected official for a very long time, and things happen. I mean, there's things that always happen on your watch. I remember when I was on the school board, a kid got killed on the playground. You have all types of unnecessary cases. But I will tell you that what I learned is very early on, you get out front, you level with people, and you let them know what happened, and you let the chips fall where they may. And that's the way I lead now, and I'll leave it at that. That's the way I lead. I don't speak for other people. But I will tell you, that's the way that I've lived my life, and that's the way that I've led my life as an elected official and as a very involved member of this community, and that's important.
Jessica emails the program saying that you mentioned you want to change RPD culture, but how exactly will you do that, given that mayors and leaders in every city in the country are talking about doing that?
Yeah, I think, I think it starts with some of the things that we talked about. Training is absolutely key. restructuring the department to make sure that they are not involved in things that are more meant for social issues. And by doing that, what you will end up doing is having police officers not be involved in things that they are not trained for. So that's important. But also ensuring the training, ensuring that we have training to ensure that police officers are able to use good common sense, able to be courteous, and able to connect with the people that they are trying to help and protect and serve. So getting back to that concept of actually being guardians and not people who are hammers and trying to see every single problem as a nail. That's going to take a lot of time. I think that one of the things that we have to be clear on is to think that it's going to change overnight. It will not, but it's going to require a consistent commitment from everyone in the community, and it starts at the mayor's office with saying this is how we're going to transform the police department. But there are some basic things that we can do, basic policy and procedures that we can do that the mayor can do when they hire a police chief to say, listen, we are not going to handcuff little kids. We're not going to spray 9-year-olds with pepper spray, right? If somebody breaks someone's jaw for jaywalking, we are not going to tolerate that. We're going to do that. We're going to make sure that they are disciplined immediately, right? So I think that has to be the way in which we start a reform conversation.
Okay, but let me just make sure that we really, this is an important distinction here. When you talk about we are not going to pepper spray little girls, we are not going to do XYZ. If you go back to September, when the first days of the public demonstrations on a nightly basis were happening, there were hundreds, if not over 1,000 people marching on a number of nights. And police responded with various forms of response, including pepper spray, deploying the kind of responses that led to some injuries. There was a sharp outcry that what the police did to respond was generally a little too much. And the mayor took several days to say anything and finally, said that she was going to ask the elders of the city to sort of try to stand and form a shield. Instead of saying what I sort of kind of, what I'm hearing from you is when you say we don't do this, you're saying if I'm mayor, the police are an extension of me and what I direct. Whereas the mayor was saying, hey, I'm going to ask the elders to do this and maybe they can get in front of the police. Instead of saying, I'm going to let them know this is not how we do things. I guess what I want to hear from you is, did you hear what the mayor said then? Did it strike you as, hey, if you're the mayor, you can't stop the police from doing X, Y, and Z. You can't control that. Or do you think, no, that was not a leadership response? A leadership response says, we don't pepper spray girls. We don't respond in this way. And do you have that control if you're the mayor?
Well, look, if I'm the mayor, unless someone tells me different, I will work to ensure that I have that control if I don't, because the police chief reports to the mayor, right? I mean, city council, for example, cannot direct the police chief, cannot direct any of those things. I've been in I've always understood government, so you can look at the duties of, for example, city council members. They can suggest, they can propose, but in terms of directing staff, the mayor directs staff, the police chief is a staff. Now, maybe it's written somewhere where they can't get involved. I don't think so, but I will tell you. And so when I say we, exactly everything that you just verbalized is yes, that's what I'm saying. I am saying that I will say that in an Evans administration, we will not use LRADs on protesters. I will say, and we should be saying now, I shouldn't even have to say this, that we don't spray little kids with pepper spray, period, period. They're not armed. They're not a danger to anyone. They're kids. So I think that we can say that because it's about who we are, and it says who we are. So in the broader context, I think sometimes we have to look at this in the broader context. Rochester, if we want Rochester to be an international city and a destination for people to want to come to, and a place where people want to be able to raise their family, and we want businesses to grow, we have to be able to say that there are certain things that we just won't do. Because, number one, it's going to make us less safe because we're not going to get cooperation from citizens when we have real crimes. And morally, we will be morally corrupt and bankrupt if we have little children being sprayed with pepper spray. So, yeah, I can say unequivocally that I will say, no, we would not do that because it's not who we are.
Josh writes to the program and asks, will you work to cut ties with the Police Locust Club?
I don't know what that means, cut ties with
the... All right, so let me try to interpret.
Yeah.
How do you evaluate the performance of Mike Mazzeo and the Locust Club? Do you think they are working for a better community?
Well, I think that it's the mayor's job to push to have every single bargaining unit to work for the better community. But you know, I mean, the police union, they are elected by their membership, right? So, you know, you sometimes get these letters that say fire the police union. That you can't do that. But I can tell you the stuff that's in my purview, the stuff that I just mentioned. Those are the things that we will work to change, right? And you have to make sure that you have contracts that hold people accountable. You have to make sure that you have training that hold people accountable. And the most important thing, even before they are hired, is the process in which you interview people to become police officers. That process is extremely important. And there's, you know, you can beef that up to ensure that you are attracting people who are going to have a love for the city and are going to be what we call a good fit, right? A good fit to work in an urban environment in the city of Rochester. So those are the types of things that we need to have larger conversations about. And I think that that's part of that transformational reform model conversation that you have. And that's important. I think that those are the things that are mission critical as we talk about changes to public safety.
My guest is Malik Evans, who is running for mayor of Rochester. He's a former member of the Rochester City School Board. He is a member of Rochester City Council, and he is running against Mayor Lovely Warren, who is running for a third term. It is a Democratic primary where they will face off, and that's in June. That's just 4 months away or so. And so if you're in the city of Rochester, that's essentially the mayoral election. I mean, there's always a general election, but the primary is generally where it's decided.
It is, but we still got November. You know, you never want to take anything for granted.
Well, no, right. I take
that. The primary is key. June 22nd is absolutely key.
I take that point. Let me get some feedback from listeners who are on the line with us, and I'm going to start with Edward in Rochester. Go ahead, Edward.
Thanks, Evan. So, Mr. Evans, I tend to think that in order to create real change, you have to have an attitude that's different. If you were to be putting in new policies and then putting the same people behind those policies, or not creating some form of change to the attitude or advocacy to adhere to this new way of thinking, then it might be just kind of the same old tool trying, you know, to put something else together. So what kind of new attitude would you create for your administration? And would it be accountable, unlike the current mayor, who tends to be very denialist and has a hard time taking accountability?
Yeah, I like that. I like your Tina Turner had a song, I Got a New Attitude. And you know, I think, you know, your attitude determines your altitude, how high you will go. And I think that people sometimes say, oh, we don't want to build bridges, but that's an attitude. That's part of a new attitude, right? Because I can tell you one of the most important things that I learned from being in elected office sometimes is that you have to be able to understand that the buck stops with you, right? And if we've seen anything at the national level, it's that there's sometimes a deflection when you're a leader because you take things personally or you internalize them. I will tell you that I'm pretty good at getting beat up, and I'm okay with that because that made me a better servant, right? So if someone's coming at me and saying, the police department is not doing this, or we need to do more with economic development, I'm gonna bring those people in and say, hey, okay, what can we do to transform this and make it better? Or if there are folks who are having differences around an issue, be it policing, be it jobs, be it housing. You have to work with all of those folks, and you have to be able to find that common ground in order to get something done for the citizens of Rochester. So I love that question about attitude, because he's right. It does require a new attitude. It does require a new approach, and that's what I would hope to bring.
All right, let me get Jane in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Jane.
Hello.
Hi, Jane.
I have followed Malik's career for 23 years, since he was 18. He spoke at the age of 18 to a group of foundation and corporate leaders, some of the major givers in the community called Rochester Grantmakers Forum, United Way folks, and he blew everybody out of the water. He talked about what the needs were in the community. He was representing youth then. He had started some key activities on behalf of youth in the community. And while he could have gone to prestigious universities elsewhere, he said, I'm staying in Rochester. I'm getting my education in Rochester, and I am going to serve the community. And just blew us all away. And so I've been following his career ever since then. I've been supporting him in certain ways. He is such a thoughtful human being and a person of absolute integrity. I just want to say I couldn't be more pleased. In fact, I contacted him about 3 months ago, and I said, Malik, will you please run for mayor? I'll support you. And he didn't really respond, so I didn't know until he went public with it. But I just want to say I am thrilled that Malik is running for mayor, and I really hope he wins. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
What is real briefly here, what does a coalition look like to you? What's been the reception among because, you know, this is a mayor with two terms. She's running for a third term. She won handily in both of her previous elections. And, you know, she has a lot of people who respect her and friends in the political establishment. What's been the response to your candidacy?
It's been overwhelming, and I've been very humbled by it. I mean, just the first week, the number of volunteers numbered in the hundreds of people who signed up just to the website, not counting volunteers that I've had throughout my career in public service. So I've been very humbled. I've been very humbled by the reception. I've been very humbled by the support that we are seeing. Obviously, the proof will be in the pudding. And we will work hard to win every single vote. I learned a long time ago, you don't take anything for granted. I believe that politics is about addition, not subtracting. So every day I look to see how I can add more people who want to support from broad-based coalitions throughout the city. And that's what we're going to focus on, because this campaign is about, you know, building those bridges. And that means connecting with different people that might disagree with you sometimes, but know that, you know what, with Malik Evans, I'm always going to have a seat at the table. I'm always going to have an ear, and I'm always going to have someone that is going to be thoughtful on the issues that are important to the community, and that we're going to work for transformational change in Rochester. As I said to people, I don't want to survive. Yeah, it's great to be a survivor, but it's better when you can thrive. And that's the same philosophy I have for the city. I want our city to thrive. I want to take our city to the next level, and I believe that it can be if we all change the things that we need to change and come together in a way that really allows us to thrive as a city.
All right, we're going to talk education in a moment, and then we'll do a little listener lightning round. But before we don't really do lightning rounds. It's public radio. But we've
a game show, Evan.
It's not a game show. We've got a lot of questions from people, and so we'll squeeze in as much as we can. I hate to do this first, though, but Jeremy writes to say, New Attitude was by Patti LaBelle.
Oh, he's right. Oh, that's right. I got it. Who did I say? Tina Turner?
Yep.
Oh, I lose 5 points. That's right. He's right. That's
so
right.
Jeremy says, other than that, I'm enjoying a robust forum of
right.
new ideas.
Patti LaBelle, I got a new attitude. That's a Tina Turner. That's right.
There you go. Little fact check for you.
There you go. In real time.
Rochester has been the only district in Monroe County until recently that was essentially full remote during the pandemic this fall and into the winter. And when you look around the country, that's been sort of the model. We see a lot of urban districts that have stayed full remote for a wide range of reasons. There's been a heavy, heavy debate. And tomorrow on this program, we'll have Adam Urbanski from RTA. We will have a conversation about, you know, why RTA has not wanted yet to be back in the classroom, given how they see the pandemic and what they're hearing from their teachers. Do you think Rochester City Schools should have been back in the classroom by now?
Well, no, I think you have a lot of people who are concerned about safety. I mean, obviously, you want to try to get kids the best instruction that you can. It's always best, obviously, if they're able to be in the classroom. Zoom is an extremely hard thing, but you have to also be able to satisfy the safety, right? The safety and security of folks. They have to feel as though they're going to be safe, and parents also have to make that ultimate decision, which I think happens. So, how do you detail to parents, hey, it's safe for you to be able to bring your children back in school. So, you know, I've talked to several principals who said hey, some of my parents don't want to come in, or some of my teachers don't want to feel safe. So, you know, when you make that type of decision, I'm glad to not have to be on the school board anymore. But you know, that's a tough decision. You have to balance educational opportunities for our kids with safety. And I personally know folks that have died from COVID. We are dealing with something that is just so scary, 102 years in the making. So we have to make sure that people feel safe. I think that, I always give this disclaimer. Remember, the mayor does not run education. City council does not run education. But I think that we will have to look at long term how we supplement the learning loss that kids may have gotten. For being out of school so long back in March, you know, when COVID really was raging, it was extremely difficult to open schools. You just couldn't do it. So no schools were open. And, you know, that has a multiplier effect, because then you have to catch up from what you did. So the question will be, how do we get people, not just in Rochester, but across the community, in private schools, parochial schools, how are they going to catch up on that learning that they lost? And I equate it like this. If you were in college for 4 years and you missed most of your sophomore year, and you were a biology major, you would have to do a lot to catch up, and our kids would be no different. So, yeah, it's a difficult situation of what schools are dealing with across the country.
Well, but at one point, can we start to conclude that the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative has failed or is failing? I mean, we're about 6 years into it. We've seen, from what I can tell, very little indication that poverty is being reduced in Rochester. Has that initiative failed?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that we have to look at the numbers, right, to see where we are from a poverty perspective. I think that it was a very important initiative. But I will tell you that one of the things that I think is extremely important is that we start having a conversation about how we can create prosperity for families, because I think that is where we have failed as a community. If you look at a lot of the conversations that we have, they're always about just services, and they're never about economic empowerment. And I will tell you that is very important to me. So as mayor, that would be the bully pulpit I would use regularly, because let's face it, you want to decrease poverty, you get people jobs, period. And that means, you know, one of the plans or proposals that we will be rolling out is, you know, public-private partnerships where if anyone wants a job in the city of Rochester, I don't care what it is, it could be shoveling snow or sweeping the sidewalk, we're going to get enough money, find a way to get enough money to get that person to get that job, because then that's going to give them that training, the soft skills, and then they'll be able to graduate on into the next thing. You pair that with education and some type of training. We have some of the best trades in the country. I mean, people come from all over the world to go, for example, to the sheet metal workers to see their facility. So how do you bridge that type of gap? If we don't start changing the trajectory and having conversations like that to say it's okay, particularly for African American and Latino, our Latino residents, to have conversations about prosperity and economic development and home ownership, which brings generational wealth, we will never get out of poverty. But I'm telling you, Evan, if you listen to most of the conversations that you have in the community, they're all from a deficit model, and it's all about poverty as opposed to empowering people economically. And I think that's what we have to do.
All right, let's try to get some quick answers on these questions. Steve says, can you speak briefly to your relationship with the LGBTQ plus community? Do you have a good relationship with that community?
Yes, I have a very great relationship with that community. the family members that represent that community, so I always have. And I can tell you that my father was like Wayne Gretzky. He went to where the puck was going to be, and we grew up knowing that community extremely well. So absolutely.
Jason says, what would be your goals regarding the current zoning code and transit supportive development? And I will couple that with another listener who's asking about, should we see more bicycle emphasis in Rochester?
Oh, wow. Look at this. Look at this. You got some, you have some folks who understand municipal government. Yeah, I think, yeah, you want to have fair zoning, right? It's important. And you also want to have maximum participation in any zonings. You know, we're doing a zoning rewrite right now that I think is extremely important. And bicycle emphasis, absolutely. Although we also need to have a better public campaign to have motorists protect bicyclists. I mean, I'm amazed at the lack of respect that, you know, bicyclists get on the road. It's a standard complaint that I hear regularly. So, yeah, more bicyclists, but we got to find a way to also have some type of safety campaign so folks won't get injured.
Steven's asking, do you support a residency requirement for police?
I do. To be honest, I don't know if it will happen. I mean, again, that's something that has to happen in Albany. But yeah, I'm an optimist, but I'm also a realist. We'll see what Albany does. But I'll say, add another point to say, the things that I will definitely focus on, I will control the controllables, and we'll have to look at what we can do to still improve policing if we don't get those things that we want from Albany. But we can't be dependent on Albany for that.
Mary called in to ask, will you take money from the teachers union for your campaign?
Will I take money from the teachers union? I'll take money from anyone that is interested in my platform and my vision. But you know, most of our donors probably will be community members. So we will take money from folks who are committed to changing the community.
And 30 seconds on developers. Do developers get a bad rap? Do you have a good relationship with them, or do you think that they've got too much power?
I will work with developers. I know some of the folks. I'm not a developer, but I will work with developers to ensure that we have equitable jobs for folks, that we are building in ways that neighbors have a voice. I will definitely build bridges to developers.
Where are you online, sir, where people can learn more about you?
MalikEvans.org. That's MalikEvans.org.
Malik Evans is running for mayor of the city of Rochester, and I am hopeful that his opponent, the incumbent, the mayor, Lovely Warren, will join us on this program as soon as we can make that happen. That'll be up to the mayor, and I certainly respect her decision one way or another. But I am grateful for the time of anyone who can give it to our listeners. Malik Evans, thank you for making the time, and I do hope we can talk soon.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having me.
MalikEvans.org for more information. And there, at least for the moment, is the only challenger for the incumbent mayor of the city of Rochester. Two candidates, two Democrats who will be on the ballot, and that is a June election. More connections coming up in a moment.